I want you to turn to the person next to you, stare deeply into their eyes. Not creepily, gentlemen. I said deeply. You should look at them and say, "You have the most beautiful eyes I have seen all day." Now, if you said that to somebody that will eventually be your future spouse, I demand an invitation to the wedding. I am a great wedding guest. I can footloose like nobody's business, right? Like, I'm all about it. Woo, yeah, I can do it. I am so stoked to be with you tonight. You have no idea. When Steubenville sent me that I was the Saturday night keynote, I was like, say what? Like, you're going to give that to me? Who do you think I am? You think I can do that? So we're going to see. We're going to have some fun with Jesus. Who in here misses their mom and dad? Anybody? Anybody? I miss my parents. I'm going to show you a picture of them. They are the most, they're watching right now, so I am totally sucking up. Hey, mom and dad. These are my awesome parents, Garland and Marie. We call them Garland, darling. My mom's a saint. She's just awesome. And my parents were super supportive of me when I was growing up. They sent me to Catholic school, and they paid for my college, which was like the best thing ever. And they've just always been very faith-filled people. My parents wake up at 4:15 every morning to go to 6:30 a.m. Mass. They are those people. She is becoming an old church woman, and I love it. She's just awesome. When I was 16 years old, I went to my mom and dad, hardworking, holy people that they are, and said, "Mom and dad, I want an iPod." Now, I'm going to give you a history lesson, kids. Once upon a time, phones only did one thing. They made phone calls. And we had these things called iPods with little click wheels, like a physical button. And it could hold about 2,000 songs. And at 16 years old, I wanted one. They were $450. And my parents looked at me and said, "You're an able-bodied young lady. Get a job." So I babysat. Any babysitters in here? Babysitters? Yeah. The only thing that qualified me to be a babysitter was that I was once a baby, but that's not, you know, relevant. What matters is that people actually hired me, and all of a sudden I had cash flow. It was awesome. And one of the little girls that I babysat was named Julia. Julia was about yay big with curly blonde hair. I also have a picture of her. She is precious. And she was just like the most delightful little girl. Like, she was just this bubbly, effervescent personality. The one weird thing about Julia was that she had a laugh like an old man. Like, you'd make her giggle and she'd go, "Ho, ho, ho." Like, it did not befit. Like, you'd think she'd have a big beer belly or something. But this little, sweet little girl, I would babysit her like 3 or 4 times a week throughout the summer. And this one particular day, we had like an awesome day together. We went out and we went to McDonald's, and then we hung out at the park, and we went and got our nails done. And we just had like the perfect day for a 3-year-old little girl that looks like that, just precious. And when we got back home, it was like 4 o'clock, and I was a good babysitter. At that point, I had skills with a Z. And I knew that if I put Julia down for a nap, her mom would pay me a little extra because it meant Julia would be sleeping when she got home. So we get back, and I'm like trying to get Julia ready for her nap. And she was like, "But Miss Katie, I got to show you something." And she sticks her hand up in the air. And if you've ever seen a 3-year-old child say, "Come with me," you'd go anywhere with them. You'd walk into Mordor with that child. So I walked with her back to their little playroom. And her mom was one of those artsy-fartsy types. Like, she hung up all of her children's artwork on the walls. That's a very practical term, artsy-fartsy. It's from the Greek. So her mom is like super, super creative with her kids' artwork. And Julia had an older brother, Grant, who's like 6 at the time. And so his artwork like looked like something. Like, there were stick figures and houses and puppy dogs. But Julia, it was nothing but scribbles. And she was so proud of her scribbles. Like, you thought I had walked into the Louvre of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Like, she was beaming with pride as she introduced me to scribbles A and scribbles B and scribbles C and then scribbles 1, 2, and 3. She had a number of series. She was like Adele. She's gonna have scribbles 25 and, you know, "Hello, it's Julia." So here we are staring at all of these scribbles, and she walks up to like the one in the corner and is just so proud. And I'm staring at it, confused as all get out. It looked like she had taken all the caps off a pack of markers and put them on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper and just done like this. Like, and I imagine that's what her face looked like. Like, she was furious. And cutting right through the middle of the paper was this big black line. Like, she'd taken the thickest Sharpie she could find and just dug it into the paper. So I'm staring at it, and she's just so happy. So I said, "Finally, Julia, what is it?" She's like, "Duh, Miss Katie, it's Jesus and his friends." And she starts telling me all about Jesus and his friends. And Jesus had friends named Larry and Gus and Mo. And strangely enough, Jesus was not very popular. He was a little red dot in the upper right-hand corner, like all by himself. He was introverted. And like, there's this big black line, and I'm so confused. And then it hits me. I bet you the black line is Judas. Like, he's like cutting through Jesus' social circle and causing distance. I'm like deeply reading into the psyche of this three-year-old's scribbly piece of paper. And so I finally get the nerve to go, Julia, what's the black line? And she looks at me like I have grown a second head. Duh, Miss Katie, it's Jesus' grandma. And so I was just like, all right, it's time for you to go to bed, kid. And I like pick her up and go and put her in the bed. And I go back to the picture like 5 minutes later. I'm staring at it, still confused. Like, how could that be, you know, Gus and Larry and Mo, and Jesus' grandma is the big black line? That makes no sense. And then it hits me. This three-year-old had just taught me one of the greatest Christological truths ever. Jesus had a grandma. When's the last time you thought about her? And if you go to a church named St. Anne's, it doesn't count. When's the last time you thought about the fact that Jesus had what I would call my grandma, a Mimi? When's the last time you thought about the fact that Jesus had a papa? When's the last time you thought about the fact that Jesus came here? That Jesus Christ, second person of the Trinity, Word made flesh, came to dwell among us here. I studied theology when I was in college. It was like the best thing ever to get to read about Jesus every day. And it always blew my mind that the way he could have come into the world, he could have like saddled up a cloud, because I imagine that's how it is in heaven, saddled up a cloud, grabbed his lasso, floated on down to heaven, shooting lightning bolts out of his eyes, going, I am Jesus, believe in me. I'm not a heretic, I promise. He could have done that, I imagine. Or he could have like sent a memo. On the 15th day of December, it's actually the 25th, I don't know why I said the 15th. On the 25th day of December, I will arrive in a chariot. Please make the arrangements necessary. But he didn't do that. He came here in a humble, simple way to be with us here. And here, he invites us into an experience of him. Here, he invites us to see how much he loves us. Loves us so much that he couldn't stand to not be here with us. He couldn't stand to be away from us. And in the Gospel of John, there's a story. John the Baptist is hanging out in the desert. John the Baptist, by the way, was the first hipster. He wore a hair shirt and he ate locusts. He was totally gluten-free. So John the Baptist is hanging out in the desert, you know, doing his John the Baptist thing. And Andrew and John are with him. And as they're standing there, Jesus walks by. And John the Baptist goes, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And Andrew and John, they run up to Jesus. And they say, Rabbi, where are you staying? It's the dumbest question in all of Scripture. You could have asked Jesus anything. And you say, where are you staying? And Jesus is my favorite kind of Jesus. Jesus gets a little sassy. Jesus doesn't say, I'm staying at the University Plaza Hotel right down the street. He doesn't give him latitude and longitude. He doesn't give him an agenda of his next 3 years of ministry. Jesus says three words that changed the course of human history. Jesus looks at them, the God-man that came here to love us, to be with us here. He looks at them and he says, come and see. Come and see. You want to know where I'm going? You want to know what I'm going to do? That's a very historically accurate representation of when he came to this earth, by the way. But he looks at them and he says those three words, come and see. Come and see what I can do for you. Come and see who I am. Come and see how I can love you. Come and see why I came here. And they go. Andrew and John have the guts to go, have the gumption to go, to leave everything behind and go with this man that came here. Go with this God that chose to be here with us. And they see some pretty incredible things. They become followers of this rabbi. They become men that stand with him through thick and thin, that pray with him in gardens, that watch him transfigure. They gather 10 other people together with them and become the hoodlums with Jesus. That's what I like to call the apostles in my spare time. These men go with Jesus and they see some incredible things. They see Word made flesh dwelling among us who came here to be with us, calm the storm. They see the God of the universe, who was taking a nap, stand up, outstretch his hands, and say, "Peace, be still." And the waters are instantly quiet. I teach freshmen. I'm going straight to heaven because of it. If I stand up and say, "Peace, be still," they laugh in my face. But here's Jesus, who just woke up from a nap and can stand up and calm the storm. And it's not just literal storms with waves and thunder and lightning that he can calm. He can calm those internal raging storms that causes so much disquiet and discomfort and pain. They go and see that day the Jesus Christ that can heal the sick. And we have this woman in the story of this woman in the scriptures who was sick for 12 years. That's more than half of your lives, many of you. 12 years this woman has been bleeding, has been outcast from society, is ashamed, and she's broke. She spends all her money on these fake doctors. And she hears about this guy. And she goes out, and in faith, she reaches out, and she touches the tassel of his cloak just a little bit, and I can be healed. And instantly, she is healed. Instant. And Jesus turns around, and he reaches out to her, and he picks her up, and he says, "Your faith has made you well." See, Jesus Christ came here to heal us of the pain and the hurt that we are experiencing in all of those storms. And he came here to sit on a mountaintop for hours on end, preaching the truth, preaching a message, literally turning the world on its head as he changed the law, as he fulfilled the teachings of the Old Testament. And then when he sees that the people are hungry, he gives them food, an abundance of food, enough with leftovers, takes what little there is and makes more and satisfies the people's hunger. He feeds them. See, the God of the universe who wants you and created you in his image and likeness came here to be with us so that he could calm storms and heal hurt and nourish us with truth. He came here and invites us to come and see how much he loves us. When he stood there that day and said to Andrew and John, "Come and see," he meant, "Come and see how much I love you. Come and see what I can do. Come and see who I am. Come and see, and your life will never be the same. Come and see." You know, growing up, I grew up in an incredibly Catholic family. Some kids grow up going to the baseball field, and some kids growing up going to the dance studio. I grew up going to church. That's where we spent our time. That's where our social life was. I played my violin in the choir. My sister altar served. Like, that's who we were. We were the Catholic family. And at a certain point in my life, I started to question a lot of that. What's this Catholic thing all about? Why does it even matter? It's something that somebody forced me into doing. I stopped going and seeing. I stopped responding to the invitation of the Lord. I stopped looking at how much he loved me and started questioning everything. And it all came to a head in September of my junior year of high school. It was a Thursday morning, 3 a.m., and my mom came into my bedroom, which was weird. It was 3 a.m., and she was holding a Tupperware container. And she shook me awake, and she set the Tupperware container down on the end of my bed, and she said, "Katie, the storm shifted. Hurricane Rita is headed straight for Lake Charles. You need to pack up all the stuff that you don't want to lose, and we're going to leave in a couple hours." So I immediately grabbed my Harry Potter books, and I put them in the Tupperware container. And then I reevaluated my life's priorities, and I put some other things in there. I remember grabbing my yearbook from, like, seventh grade. I guess it was a good year. And a couple of other, like, random knickknacks. There was a certificate for my first communion. I remember putting that in there. Just random stuff all around the room. But I was so angry. Why would God do this? Why couldn't he just send that storm somewhere else? Why couldn't he just evaporated that storm? Because it was coming straight from my hometown. And when we left that morning at 6 a.m. to drive up to my grandparents' house, 2 hours away in Alexandria, I didn't know if I was coming home to a home. My parents' house is up on 9-foot piers on the bayou, that's a thing, surrounded by glass, and we have trees all in our yard. So if the water wasn't going to get us, a roof was going to come off, and rain was going to come in, or a window was going to get broken by one of those tree limbs, I was prepared to come home to nothing. And I was so mad. We got to my grandparents' house 6 hours later. 2-hour drive took 6 hours because of all the people trying to get out of town, and proceeded to watch the news. And there's something really surreal about all of your prized possessions being in a Tupperware container on the floor next to you as you watch Anderson Cooper stand on your street in knee-deep water, knowing that the water is rising, knowing that the storm is getting worse. This was my parents' street the day after the storm. What really hurt was when 2 days after the storm, my dad had to get in his car and drive back to Lake Charles, a town that was full of looters at this point, because he was working for a bank. And so he needed to make sure that things were okay at the bank. So I was legitimately concerned for my father's life every evening when I went to bed, because I knew that he was sleeping in the living room in our house with a generator that could run either the AC or the fridge and a shotgun next to him. 3 weeks into the evacuation, I had to enroll in a new school. But we were pretty sure we were going to be able to move back home in the next couple of months, so I didn't buy any of the new uniforms. So I was wearing my old school uniform at this new school, which I'm already an awkward person, so it got even weirder. It was the worst 3 months of my life. About halfway through the evacuation, I went into the bedroom at my grandparents' house, and I was, for the first time in my life, sharing a bedroom with my sister, so I like had no alone space at all. And I was so angry, I was so angsty. I just wanted to go home, I just wanted to see my friends, I just wanted my dad to be back with us. I was scared, I was confused, I was tired, I was hurt. And I walked into the room and I slammed the door behind me. And as I slammed the door, I heard something fall. And I turned around and this little crucifix that my grandma had on the wall had fallen on the ground. And the body on the crucifix had popped off. I literally broke Jesus. And I'm standing there staring at it, and I turned around and I walked out. As far as I was concerned, it was a useless piece of art. Because where was that God when my mom woke me up and told me, pack your things? Where was that God when I watched my friends' homes flood and roofs fly off? Where was that God when I was scared for my father's life? Where was that God when I was in the storm? Where was he when I was in pain? Where was he when I needed to be fed? He was right there all along, saying, come and see how much I love you. See, if we ever think that that storm is too big for him, or that hurt is too much for him, or that we are too hungry and too thirsty to where he cannot satisfy us, we are dead wrong, because he's right there. He's right there loving us perfectly. Right there loving us to the limit, loving us so much that he went into the city of Jerusalem on the back of a donkey to prepare for his death. Loves us so much that he had dinner with his friends for the last time, knowing that he was washing the feet of people that would betray him and deny him. Loves us so perfectly that he went into a garden and literally sweat blood from fear. And there's a moment in that garden. I can only imagine what must have been going through his head. We can read it. It's essentially Jesus saying, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. If it's your will, let this cup pass from me. And then there's a breath. But Father, not my will, but your will be done. He loves us so perfectly in the hurt and in the storm and in the hunger and thirst. He loves us so perfectly that he is willing to walk upstairs to be condemned, to be beaten, to be scourged, to be humiliated. The Roman soldiers grabbing a wooden stick, a cat of nine tails, strips of leather coming off the end, rock and glass embedded within it, and they threw it into his back and then wrenched it out. And in that moment, he was calming storms and healing pain and feeding our hunger and satisfying our thirst. That perfect love endured each blow for you. Every ounce of blood dropped had the name of a person he loved on it. He loves us abundantly, not a little bit, in little itty-bitty bits and pieces to be parceled out as if we're somehow rationed with the love of God. He loves us so much that he was willing to endure that beating, endure a night in prison, endure thorns shoved into his forehead. And then they hand him a beam, splintery, heavy, place it on the shoulders with open wounds that had scabbed over the course of the evening. And he's made to walk through the streets at the most crowded time of the year. And as he walks, he stumbles. And as he walks, he meets his mother. And as he walks, he stumbles again. And as he walks, he meets women weeping. And as he walks, he falls. And every moment of that journey was a witness to his abundant love, was a witness to him calming your storm and healing your hurt and satisfying your thirst. He loves us infinitely. There is no end. There is no limit. So much so that after being whipped, after carrying that beam, he's brought to the place of the skull, the place of death. And they place him down on top of that beam and they grab nails and they hammer them into his feet, shoving through the tendons. And they wrench apart his arms, pulling them out of the sockets. And they nail his hands into that same beam he just carried. And they place him high for all to see. And as he hangs there on that cross, his abundant, perfect, infinite love is stretched out. His abundant, perfect, infinite love is there for you to come and see. How much does he love us? That much. That abundant, perfect, infinite love that we are invited to receive. As his lungs are collapsing in on themselves, he's pushing himself up to gasp for breath. His mother is standing there at the foot of the cross. You can only imagine the hurt of a mom watching her son be executed. His friend John holding her close, comforting her as Jesus says, "Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother," giving Mary to the church. As he's gasping for breath, thinking of you, thinking of every sin and how he's wiping it away, thinking of every moment where you hurt and every moment where you're angry and every moment where you're scared and every moment where you feel inadequate and every moment where you're joyful, thinking of every moment of your life, he gasps for breath one last time and says, "I thirst." He's not thirsty for water. He's not thirsty for wine. He's thirsty for you. I thirst for you. I'm here for you. I'm on this cross. I've endured this beating. I've carried this beam. I have allowed these nails to be dug into my hand. I have let these thorns be shoved into my forehead. I am gasping for breath as I suffocate for you, because you're worth it. Because even in those moments where that storm is raging, and even in those moments when that hurt is so intense, and even in those moments when you are so desperate for that thirst to be quenched, here I am, thirsting for you, wanting you to reach out to these arms that are open wide, wanting you to grab hold of me, wanting you to love me so that I can love you. It blows my mind every time that he wants me. I look in the mirror sometimes and I don't see somebody that's lovable. I see somebody that messes up. I see somebody that sins. I see somebody that gossips. I see somebody that lies. I see somebody that's selfish. I see somebody that falls every day. And he did that for me? Why am I worthy of that? And he did that for me, and he wants me. He thirsts for me. He desires me. do I thirst back? Now, last night in this room, it was powerful. Again and again, we prayed these words, Lord, I need you. Oh, I need you. Every hour, I need you. And how true. We do need him. We need him to step into that storm and calm it. We need him to step into that hurt and heal it. We need him to step into our thirst and quench it. We need him. Lord, I need you. And he looks back at us and says, and I want you. The God of the universe who needs nothing, who in and of himself is completely and totally perfect, stepped into this world, came here because he wants you. And we speak in these lofty terms. God died. Jesus saved the world. If you were the only person that ever existed, he still would have done it. He loves you so much that he was willing to lay down his life so that you could be in eternity with him someday. He wants you so much that he took every blow, he took every drive of the nail, he took every thorn in the forehead. He loves you so much that he will come to us tonight to reach out to us again, to thirst for us again. And we must say yes. We are invited to say, I want you back. I need you back. I am nothing without you. I walked back into that bedroom where the crucifix had fallen on the floor about an hour later. And I picked it up and I brought it to my grandparents in the hopes that, you know, they wouldn't be mad at me for breaking something. And my grandma could tell something was wrong. And I just lost it. Just lost it. I was a 16-year-old kid. I was supposed to go get my driver's license the weekend we evacuated. And my whole life had been uprooted. And I thought he was gone the whole time. And my sweet grandma, she's like 4 or 5, white blonde hair, just this adorable lady. She took my hands into hers and she held the crucifix between the two of us. And she said, it's okay. He would have done it for you whether you wanted him to or not. And he's right here with you in all of your hurt. Because he wants you. And he wants you to come to him tonight, vulnerable and open, broken, so that he can put you back together. So that he can pull you into those arms that are stretched open on the cross. So that he can calm that storm and heal that hurt and nourish your thirst. I'm going to invite you to close your eyes for just a second. Lord, we come to you tonight and we know you want us, and help us to feel that thirst evermore. And help us to thirst for you. Help us to cry out that we need you and listen to you say, I want you.